I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. 50 years ago, Northern Dancer was famous the world over, having won two of the Triple Crown races in the United States, the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. In Canada, he won the Queen's Plate and was a beloved figure for all. A new book looks at Northern Dancer's 1964 campaign and goes back to tell the story of E.P. Taylor, the Canadian industrialist who changed the sport of kings in Canada, how he brought Northern Dancer together with the Argentinian Horatio Luro, a dapper trainer. He's a fascinating figure, as is Bill Hartack, the jockey who rode Northern Dancer. The book's author, Kevin Chung, joins me now to talk about it and the hero status that for Canadians embodied more than a winner. It was the changing of the country. I'll ask Mr. Chung about that, what it might have established for Canadians, as well as what perhaps made Northern Dancer as remarkable a thoroughbred as he was, and how his legacy lives on today. Kevin Chung is the author of four other books. His more recent ones were the memoir My Year of the Racehorse and the novel Beauty Plus Pity. He is an instructor in the creative writing department at the University of British Columbia and contributes to a range of publications. The full title of the book is Northern Dancer, the Legendary Horse That Inspired a Nation. It's published by Viking. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Kevin Chung. Mr. Chung, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So when you were on last fall, we talked about this book, and I said I couldn't wait to read it, and so I read most of it over the weekend, and I must say, I couldn't put it down. It was just a great read. It's tough to put down. It's a fascinating, I mean, he's a fascinating horse to begin with, but I mean, it was a fascinating time for the country. Well, what sets this book apart from, say, other books on Northern Dancer?
Well, that's a good question, because there are already, by my count, at least three other biographies of the horse, one which is for kids. I feel like this book is different because it really focuses on Northern Dancer's Triple Crown campaign in 1964, and doesn't focus as much as the other books do on his breeding career. So I'm looking at the sort of sights and sounds of 1964. I want to put the horse in historical context, place him in Canada 50 years ago. And because for a lot of people, the Northern Dancer story is completely new. They're foreign. The Canada 50 years ago is foreign to them. And so I want them to just read this as though this is the first time they've heard the story, even though they may have heard something about this horse. The name is probably still floating around for a lot of people, but they don't really know the full story and all the characters involved.
Well, what was Canada like 50 years ago? And I mean, you're not old enough to have lived through the era, but you sort of capture it in this book.
Well, in Canada in 1964, in some ways I recognize it. It's weird. Like,
yeah.
I grew up in the 80s in Canada, and there are elements of that era that were still there that aren't here anymore. And so it's funny to see how times change. In 1964, there was a lot of coverage about American ownership of Canadian business. That doesn't seem to be as much of a concern now, but Canadians were very, very insecure about how they were going to be swallowed up by the U.S. and how, in some ways, that they could never compete with the U.S. I think there's been things that have been done since that have sort of change that sort of feeling, but I think Northern Dancer was one of the first examples for Canadians that the best Canadian horse, the best Canadian, could beat the best Americans.
And was that one of E.P. Taylor's goals, was to show up the Americans, say?
I think his goal wasn't so much patriotism as it was just to be the best. I think he was somebody who always took on new businesses as a way of challenging himself. He made his first fortune in brewing, but he also had interest in real estate. He helped build one of the first planned suburbs, Don Mills. He owned forestry interests. He owned fast food interests. He owned grocery stores. He just wanted to dabble in all sorts of things. And he was a big fan of the races. And when he decided to buy into thoroughbreds, he didn't just want to just play around. He wanted to be the best.
Yeah, and so the other thing that was fascinating was the state of horse racing in Canada before Taylor gets involved in all of it. I mean, it was pretty unorganized, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in Ontario, the racing circuit was known as the Leaky Tins Roof Circuit. There were terrible facilities, the horses were subpar, and cheating and race-fixing was rampant. So Taylor really lifted up the Ontario racing circuit and the Canadian racing circuits through his own efforts. He, at one point, became the CEO of the Ontario racing body, and he helped to build Woodbine, which is still one of the top race courses in North America. And he did a lot.
Now, Northern Dancer was born in 1961, is that right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, so did Taylor own him from the beginning? Did he breed him, say?
He bred him using some of the best bloodlines available. Like, through him, through Taylor's efforts, Northern Dancer had Native Dancer, one of the greatest horses of the 1950s, in his bloodline. He had Nearctic in his bloodline, and through Nearctic he had Nearco. He bred him, but he couldn't sell him at auction. He tried to sell him in his own Winfield auction to Canadian buyers at the price of $25,000. It was a reserve price, and the reserve was not met. A few people considered him, but ultimately they decided not to buy the stocky brown colt because he was so short. I think generally racehorses are around 16 hands, around 64 inches. Northern Dancer was 15 hands and a quarter, maybe 61. So he was just really short, but he was really, really muscular.
And I guess Taylor knew right away that this was a special horse. I mean, you read in the book of the relationship that they had, the Taylors, Mr. and Mrs. Taylor, with it.
Mrs. Taylor was really fond of Northern Dancer because he was so stocky and small and feisty. Even for a racehorse, he was feisty, because generally thoroughbreds are pretty energetic, princessy sort of animals. Taylor, I think, saw some promise in the horse, but because of the fact that he didn't grow as much as Taylor and his associates wanted, they sort of felt like his stock had dropped. But then, when he was 2 years old, he won a couple of races, and then I guess his stock rose again.
And so how did Taylor get involved with the trainer, Horatio Luro? Which, by the way, when you read the beginning of the book and you read about Mr. Luro's exploits, I mean, that's just worth the price of the book itself.
Horatio Luro was a great character.
Yeah.
He was a master of the one-liner. And he was a tango dancer, he was a pilot, he was a race car driver, he once fought in a duel, and I guess their first connection was that Luro sold a horse to Taylor that ended up to being one of Taylor's best stud horses. And I think in the late 1950s, early 1960s, Luro began training for Taylor, and the horses that Luro would train for Taylor included Northern Dancer's parents, Nearctic, and Northern Dancer's mother, whose name just eludes me right now. Anyhow, so it was natural for Northern Dancer to Natalma is the name of Northern Dancer's mother. It's natural for Northern Dancer to be trained by Luro.
So I've been reading about some horses on Wikipedia,
yeah.
And it struck me that the mothers, the mares, they're not. I mean, are they not as important as who sired the horse?
No, some would say that the mothers are more important. I think even E.P. Taylor believes that the mother contributes more to the outcome of the colt or the or the filly than the stallion or sire does. But it's just pure economics, or just pure numbers or logistics. A sire can have about 90 to 100 foals a year,
mm-hmm.
whereas an American breed once every 11 months. So it's basically once a year for maybe 20 years. And so you just have more opportunities to produce great runners if you're a stallion, and you make more money if you have a great sire versus having a great broodmare.
The relationship that the owner, the trainer, and the jockey have, that's obviously important, that they all get along. And so how did the three of them, Taylor, Leroux, and Bill Hartack, I mean, what was their relationship throughout?
Hartack was notoriously feisty. He was known, and he prided himself on his quote-unquote honesty. That kind of honesty sometimes meant saying hurtful things, being less than diplomatic. And weirdly enough, Leroux, who's this ultra-mannered continental Argentinian, and Hartack got along really well because Hartack always felt like Leroux accepted or listened to his advice on a horse. So Leroux and Hartack got along really well, and Taylor and Hartack, I think they got along fairly well, though ultimately I think Taylor was miffed that Hartack rode Northern Dancer the way he did at the Belmont.
And that's the race that he lost, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What is the average career, say, for a horse like Northern Dancer? Is it as short as Northern Dancer's was?
No, some would say it's a bit longer. A racehorse generally starts racing at the age of two. When they run the classic races, they're age three. But they get to the physical prime at age five. So when they're at age three, they're like basically what an 18-year-old is like. You know, they're fully grown, but they're not fully grown out. They're kind of gangly. And a lot of racehorses can run until they're five, six, or seven. Seabiscuit famously rode until he was around six. But generally, when you're dealing with a horse that has value as a stud, you want to see them race into the third or fourth year and then retire them so they can breed. Because if they get injured and are unable to mount a horse in the breeding shed, then they've lost most of their value.
So the Kentucky Derby is the first leg of the Triple Crown. So Northern Dancer, does he get under 2 minutes? I can't remember. Or was it exactly 2 minutes?
It was 2 minutes flat, which was the best time ever.
And then I guess Secretariat ran it under two, right?
Yeah, Secretariat ran it under two, and his record still stands. And I think there have been a couple of other horses who have either matched or passed Northern Dancer's time, but his time is still, I think, in the top five.
Yeah, and I guess that would be the first Canadian horse to ever win that. Is that right?
Yes, and only one of two. Sonny's Halo won it in the 1980s, too. He's the other Canadian-bred horse.
What did that mean for E.P. Taylor to win the Kentucky Derby?
I think a lot of horse industry people began to take him seriously. He was just known as this upstart Canadian. He had a couple of good horses. He had a horse named Victoria Park, who in 1961, or I think 1962, I forget, very closely was a Kentucky Derby contender, but finished third. And he had spent a lot of money on horses, but hadn't really had the results. And so for him to win the Derby, it was really validating.
And then overnight, Northern Dancer was a real figure of admiration in this country, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. He was a national hero. He received so much fan mail that Taylor had to hire a secretary just to answer his fan mail. he was beloved by little girls, but also by, like, hardened racetrack bettors. He became, like, dinner table conversation. And, you know, horse racing was bigger 50 years ago than it is now, but even then, to have, like, a supper table conversation about Northern Dancer shows you that he was, like, a celebrity. He was Gordie Howe. He was, like, a matinee idol.
He was Athlete of the Year that year, wasn't he? Yeah.
He beat Gordie Howe. He beat George Shavallo.
Yeah.
He beat them all.
Because you spent some time in the book talking about what Northern Dancer meant to Canada and sort of the changing that was happening. I mean, this, in 1964, I guess, we had a new flag. It seemed to be a very nationalistic time, and I guess this Northern Dancer was part of all of that, right?
The flag didn't really get finalized until 1965, but around Pearson introduced his first design for the flag, which is incredible to see. I knew nothing about that. And before that, they were using the Union Jack.
The Red Ensign, yeah.
Yeah. And Pearson wanted to use a Canadian flag that honored the maple leaf, which was a symbol for Canadian soldiers in World War I, and that's when Pearson served. But his flag mock-up had three little flags in the middle and the red bars. And it's quite shocking to see it, to see that flag, to see what could have been. And I think around that time, Canadians were very anxious about whether we were going to stay Canadians, whether or not, you know, we were going to be absorbed by the U.S. or Quebec. I think stirrings of nationalism had begun there.
Yeah.
And we weren't sure whether or not we were going to last. And I think this little boost of national pride, of this national backslapping, really helped the country. Keep in mind also that I think a lot of people were gambling illegally, and I think a lot of people were placing sentimental bets on Northern Dancer. They'd put $5 or $10 on a Canadian horse, and the horse paid out. So basically, Northern Dancer gave all these Canadian bettors, like tens of thousands of them probably, maybe hundreds of thousands of them, a little windfall. And so there was a lot of good feeling around that horse.
And when we hear of Canadians winning at the Olympics, say, winning medals at the Olympics, it's a certain confidence that one can sort of trace back to the Northern Dancer era. And I guess that really was the first time that Canadians felt we could win.
I think so. I forget when the previous Winter Olympics was, but the previous Winter Olympics, Northern Dancer, no, there wasn't a gold medal.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up and not seeing any gold medalists at the Olympics, not even when Calgary hosted the Olympics.
Yeah.
I wasn't a single Canadian gold medalist. And now, you know, we're at the top of the leaderboard, and I think our attitudes really changed. I'm not sure Northern Dancer is one who contributed to it, but I feel like we have a different mind frame, and Northern Dancer was one of the first people that showed Canadians that we could be the best.
Northern Dancer is considered the greatest sire of his breed. I guess that's measured by the success of his progeny. I mean, they're all over the world, and when you hear of, say, these three races, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont, a lot of the horses participating even today have Northern Dancer's blood, right?
Yeah, every year, remember the Kentucky Derby is the final lineup is announced. Someone sort of calculates the bloodlines of the horses, and generally, I think between 70 to 80 to 90% of those horses have some of Northern Dancer's blood in them.
Huh.
And they're on both sides of their family tree.
Yeah. The Kentucky Derby, I guess that's in a month or so. Is that right?
I think at the first Saturday of May.
Yeah, is that a big deal for you? Did you watch that?
It's fun. I always keep an eye on it. I'm a horse racing fan, but I'm not. I don't keep up on who the contenders are for the Kentucky Derby. And I generally, if I'm at the track watching the race, I'll put some money down. But I'm not a great gambler.
Do you remember when it was when you first heard of Northern Dancer? I mean, because you've been fascinated with Taylor and Northern Dancer for a long time. Was that around the time that you started in the horse business yourself?
Oh, no, it was way before that. Yeah. I'm sure I've heard about him since, at least since he passed away in 1990.
Yeah.
He's sort of been a name that I'm familiar with. I think anyone who has any sort of passing interest in racing who comes from Canada will hear Northern Dancer's name over and over again. But even before that, I think his name was in the ether.
Yeah, and do you have a sense of why we should remember him today?
Because he was, a star. Because he was the best for a brief moment. And he was one of the first Canadians who ever sort of rose to that level, to that threshold. And because he has a great story. He ran four great races, one of which he didn't win. And he was owned by Canada's most notorious tycoon. And he was trained by one of racing's most colorful trainers. And he was ridden by the most decorated Kentucky Derby jockey ever. His story is really, really hard to top. And even though it's well known, I think for a new generation of Canadians, it's a story that's yet to be discovered.
There's a gorgeous, I mean, the book has many gorgeous lines, but one of my favorites, which I've written down, that I like, it's near the end. The past doesn't become the present with a flip of a switch. Bit by bit, the future is gained with every forgotten moment. I mean,
thank
that's
you.
Staggering how good that is. The Mad Men begins Sunday. It's the first half of its seventh season. I'm sure you'll be watching that with great interest.
Yeah, they're on to 1968.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the end of 68, because I guess they were at Christmas when it ended.
67?
Was it 67? Because I remember I saw a Nixon ad, and then they made mention that Jackie Kennedy had married Onassis.
Ah, maybe it's 68. It's been too long.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to throwing my Sundays away just watching Mad Men twice.
I do the same thing. I watch it, like, the early one and then the after. Because there's so much in it that you miss, you sort of miss it. That you miss stuff in it that you have to watch it a second time to get it all.
Yeah, all the little literary allusions on the metaphors and how they play out over different storylines. It's really fun for people who like to read books. It's got a real literary quality to it in terms of the way the story is told. And, I'm excited to see what's going to happen. I'm a little sad it's the final season, but in some ways it's good because I can sort of regain my Sunday nights again in the spring.
Yeah, well, it's 7 weeks this year,
yeah,
and then another 7 weeks next year.
Yeah,
which feels like agony for me. I mean, because either I want it to continue or I want it to end. You know,
I know where you're coming from. I just watched How I Met Your Mother, the finale, and that ending was so divisive, and it left me really rattled and angry and sad through that night. It was really ridiculous how a sitcom finale could do that to a person, and I'm not that big of a fan of the show, but it was really funny how they grow attached to characters.
Yeah, no, I watched, I guess, the first half of the first season.
Yeah.
And then I stopped watching it. But then, of course, if you know of the show, you want to know how it plays out over 9 years. So I sort of was reading about it. What I found really amusing was the writer in the Globe and Mail. It wasn't Doyle, it was someone else. She wrote the day after that she thought the finale was great, and then the next day said, no, I was wrong, I thought it was crap.
Yeah, I've come to think it's okay. I mean, I've made my peace with it now. But I think for someone who only watched the first season, to watch the finale, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But they just dragged it on so long that the finale didn't make sense, because the initial coupling between Ted and Robin, people have long forgotten about. No one cares about it anymore, and it's more about the mother, and then she gets killed off. It was just really disappointing. And anyone who's listening to this, and I ruined the ending for you, I'm sorry.
This is, you wrote on Facebook the other day that this is the third book in about 2.5 years, is that right? Yeah, are you working on another book now?
I'm trying to write a historical novel. I'm in the research stage of that. So it's early days. There won't be a book next year, I guarantee that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds patronizing, but I'm not. This is just such a gorgeously written book, and just an elegantly written book. Congratulations on this, and good luck with it.
Thank you, Joseph.
The book is called Northern Dancer, The Legendary Horse That Inspired a Nation. It's published by Viking. It's author Kevin Chong. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.